When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, it's David Averin, and welcome to the Why Customers Leave podcast. You know, everyone in business serves an audience. Some call them customers, others might call them clients or guests or associates or constituents. And in healthcare, we call them patients, of course. And at different times, we are all one of those consumers on the buying side of the equation. We're all consumers as well, right? Well, my guest today is here to talk about the ways that we access healthcare today and how a new generation of physician entrepreneurs is redefining patient engagement and the patient experience. I'm talking with Dr. Arlen Myers, President and CEO of the Society of Physician Entrepreneurs. I'm David Averin, and this is the Why Customers Leave podcast, back in 20 seconds.
Are you ready to future-proof your business? Well, sit back, because customer experience expert David Averin brings you the Why Customers Leave podcast, featuring outspoken thought leaders and business builders as they share their creative strategies for serving a new generation of customers and clients. Listen in, or you can watch the video version of the conversation. Now, here's David Averin.
Thanks, and welcome again to the Why Customers Leave podcast. Great opportunity for me to talk about how we engage as consumers, as business owners, entrepreneurs, in different aspects of our life within different realms. As I said in the introduction, you know, sometimes we are the provider and sometimes we're the consumer, and it takes so many different forms. I think one of the most significant changes post-COVID is what's happened to healthcare. And what a lot of people don't realize is that healthcare had begun many of those changes far before that. I look back in my career in the early part in my 20s. I worked in healthcare for several years. I was PR director at Children's Hospital. I worked at the Denver City Health Department, and I lobbied at our state legislature for health issues. Back then, they were talking about telemedicine. It's sort of in the way of, how do you approach and serve rural areas? How can somebody maybe on the other side of the planet with a computer and robotic arms do surgery? We think about how much has changed since then. And of course, accelerated in many ways because of COVID. Well, my guest today, Dr. Arlen Myers, who is a colleague who I've known for over 30 years, has been that person who has been everything on the from the clinical side to the teaching at the medical side, and now on the entrepreneurial side. Let me give a quick, do his quick introduction so I can do this justice, and then we'll say hi. Dr. Myers is Professor Emeritus of Otolaryngology and Dentistry and Engineering at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and the Colorado School of Public Health. And he's president and CEO of the Society of Physician Entrepreneurs. He helps people get their biomedical ideas to patients by teaching, working, and working with entrepreneurs and leading a global not-for-profit biomedical and clinical innovation and entrepreneur network. That is a mouthful. Dr. Myers, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You know, I would love to talk about, because we look in different realms. And of course, I'm on that business side of saying, how can organizations, businesses in all these different realms provide a better experience? But you come from a really unique perspective where you really understand what patient engagement looks like and how that might differentiate from experience. Tell us a little bit about your background and your perspective on how we're serving and how we're accessing care today.
Sure. So the short version, as you mentioned, is my first career was as an academic ear, nose, and throat surgeon at the University of Colorado. I did that for many, many years. And then I pivoted and changed my sort of career transition to what I would call an accidental entrepreneur. A team that I was part of invented a gadget that optically detects cancer in the mouth. And that led down a road where I was clueless. I had no idea what to do with this idea. No one was helping me. I didn't have education. I didn't have any skills, any of that. So that led to my next idea or transition was, well, I guess we're going to need to teach people how to do this. So that's how I wound up now doing what I'm doing, which is educating, consulting, and running the Society of Physician Entrepreneurs.
So talk to us about throughout your experience, and you've seen change after change, but not just on the clinical side, not just the advancements in terms of diagnostic capabilities, but in terms of how we access care and how on the care side, care is provided. Talk to us about some of those milestones and what brought us to care.
Right. So my view is that we're presently experiencing what I call sick care 4.0. So first of all, we don't have a healthcare system. We have a dysfunctional sick care system of systems in the United States. We spend now $4.3 trillion, more than any country in the world. We arguably get the least value from outcomes of any industrialized country in the world. And it's just continuing to get bigger and bigger and bigger, with causing all kinds of problems. So what has happened over the brief history, and you know, this is like the Guido Sarducci 5-minute university. So here's the 5-minute university on the history of healthcare in the United States. So it starts off with basically private practice, people running around in buggies, getting paid with chickens, and that kind of thing. That then morphed into hospital-based integrated delivery networks, a social transition of care that was basically described by Paul Starr in a book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine, in the 70s. Then that evolved into corporate care. So now we see all sorts of corporate consolidations and corporations, for-profit corporations running systems. And that's the third evolution. And now I think we're in the realm of what I call sick care 4.0, which is retail care. So you see CVS, you see Google, you see everybody under the sun that's running a retail enterprise, including what I call Amazon, because Amazon Prime is now all over the place in terms of sick care delivery. So we're in a realm of retail sick care. And that creates a different mindset. So I think in terms of patient engagement, how you engage and the reason you engage the end user, however you define them, has a big impact. And it basically determines budgets, processes, impact, results, engagement, et cetera, experience, et cetera, et cetera.
But let me ask you a question. I mean, let's talk about the differences between sort of patient engagement and patient experience. I read an article that you wrote 8 years ago, where you were talking about this specifically, that on the patient engagement side, the importance of that ultimate goal of positive clinical outcomes. How do we empower the individual as opposed to an organizational responsibility, the individual on the provider side, the individual on the patient side, and working collaboratively and educating them to create a great outcome? The experience is something different, right? That's how do we as consumers access the system. Are you finding those two goals at odds in that 4.0? Are you finding a stress in the system where providers are pressured in terms of time, harder and harder to get access because there's a cost involved?
Yes. So
you have an inside view.
Yeah. So here's the view. First of all, I think that the objectives of retail medicine, for example, when you measure engagement, if you're an e-commerce marketer, you're measuring engagement by the number of clicks and the click-throughs and the dwell time and all these other social media metrics. If you're measuring engagement in sick care, it's really not just about, as you inferred, education. Education does not change behavior. So the importance of engagement, and incidentally, this applies to doctors as well. The holy grail is to change doctor and patient behavior. Right. Because patients and doctors aren't doing the right thing now in many, many instances. In the case of doctors, they're doing things they shouldn't do. They're not doing things they should do. And the same applies for patients. So if you take, for example, the U.S. Preventive Task Force outlines maybe 5 or 6 things every American should do to stay well. Diet, exercise, relaxation, seatbelts, don't own a gun. The number of people who actually do that is less than 10%. So we have a long way to go to change patient and doctor behavior. And how you get there has to work through a series of interventions. It starts with education, which in my opinion is the least important part of the ultimate engagement outcome, that is changing behavior. Education then results in experience. In other words, how do I feel about how you're, quote, telling me or selling me on what I need to do? And this applies to vaccination compliance. It applies to COVID vaccine, you right. name it. It's any public health initiative. So it starts with education. It goes to experience. And that leads to engagement. In other words, am I now beginning to understand and adopt awareness, attention, decision, action? Am I beginning to think, gee, maybe I need to change what I'm doing? And then the final E, and I call this the four E's, is enablement. How do you enable a person to change their behavior once they've decided they want to do it?
Okay, but here's a challenge. Or you tell me, I'm not going to put this on you. I'm interested in your perspective. We are in a culture right now of silver bullets. We're looking for shortcuts for everything. You watch the infomercials, you can rock the pounds away. You can be on the chocolate pudding diet. But it's manifesting in almost every purchase decision that we're making, whether it's food or services and others as well. When you talk about sick care, which I think is very much the challenge, people come in when there's a problem, right? They come in because they search something up on Google, fix this problem, as opposed to making those decisions. And too often, as we are later in life, we're wishing that we did. How are doctors, how is medicine with a big M, how is the industry approaching, I mean, the universal wisdom in terms of what it takes for us to, we've known this for a long time, to get healthy, but are you challenged now? Are healthcare providers challenged by people wanting a quick solution, wanting the pill, wanting the easy answer and not willing to do the hard work?
So the short answer is yes, but you're asking the wrong person. In other words, and the fact that you use the term provider is a reflection of viewing patients as customers, in my opinion. So what you really should be asking is, in a highly regulated industry that has fought a 100 years war on sick care reform, that is universal coverage and payment, it goes back to the progressive era and Teddy Roosevelt. And there's a very good book actually called The 100 Years War on Sick Care Policy, which I'd suggest. But the short version is we haven't gotten there yet. And the problem is that, the change in the system and what will ultimately drive behavior change is not something a doctor talks to a patient about in the examining room. It happens in hearing rooms in Congress. In other words, you have to change the rules to change sick care to health care. It starts with changing the rules, because rules, that is, particularly reimbursement, coverage, insurance, incentives to do the right thing, all that stuff, regulation, it starts in the hearing room and ultimately results in legislation. The legislation then creates ecosystems. Ecosystems create business models, and business models drive compliance and incentives. So it has to start, in my opinion, with rules change.
Well, let me ask you a question. Is that Pollyannish? I mean, certainly in the political environment that we're dealing with right now, where as in terms of timing, because these podcasts are a little evergreen, we got one party controlling one house, another one controlling the other in the presidency, and neither of them will allow each other to pass anything. And does it require a measure of collaboration, a greater measure of collaboration to even seeing that?
Yes. So the short answer is it Pollyannish? No. Does it take a long time to create change at this level? Of course. It's taken 100 years to get to where we are now.
Right.
And by the way, it takes on average about 17 years for a healthcare discovery to ultimately become the standard of care. So this is not a short-term fix. You have to take the long view. That doesn't mean you don't do it.
Right.
It just
means where are we in the process? Are the forces in place to advocate, to be able to quantify the benefit and the dangers of inaction? Are those
forces? Yes, because, so for example, The latest poll indicated that roughly 55% of Americans were dissatisfied with the sick care system.
Sure.
Every person listening to this podcast, I guess, has had a horrible experience with the sick care system or has a relative who has. I mean, it's just pervasive. You know, it's pervasive.
Yeah.
Number two, the numbers favoring. Now, I'm not an advocate or a dissenter as far as universal coverage. Do I think that's a good idea? Maybe. Depends on, you know, the devil's in the details. But the vast majority of Americans now favor what they perceive to be single payer. In other words, government covered care.
Right.
And we can get into the weeds. It's an option. Right. We're seeing states trying to do this. Some have been successful, some have been unsuccessful, like Colorado. And so more and more, we're beginning to see, and as people increasingly go bankrupt from medical bills, which is the number one cause of the personal bankruptcy. So I think, and ultimately, people are fed up at some point with the political gridlock. They just want folks to fix things.
Right.
So I think eventually we'll get there. Whether I live to see it, who knows? But I do think we're going to get there. And that's really one of the reasons we created the Society of Physician Entrepreneurs, was to empower people to change the system through the deployment of innovation and entrepreneurship.
And to make a good living bringing those products to market, which is
do well by doing good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's talk about if we are subjected to the reality that we have today, we can certainly be advocates for the kinds of change, realists in terms of what it's going to take to make that happen. But I like when you talked about sort of we shifting in sort of the retailization of healthcare, at least the services provided. I'll give you an example. An hour and a half ago, I had to go do a quick blood draw. My physician, who I actually am working with out of plan for something separate, said, go do a blood draw. And I went to a lab place, and there's a single kiosk, and people are struggling to get their information in. I'm ninth in line, thinking I've got to get back for this podcast. And there are four people at the front desk who would and could not help or could not help anybody. We'd ask, can you check some people? You got to go through the kiosk, right? So here's a separate small company creating their own systems for that patient experience. The engagement comes later on. Where are you seeing some of the most beneficial advancements in access? And where are some of the bottlenecks or maybe unanticipated bottlenecks? Right.
Well, the good news is that, you know, the CVSs, the Minute Care inside, or the clinics, the Minute Clinics inside of, for example, Safeway or a grocery store, something like that. I mean, that is, it's shifting the value proposition of sick care, in my opinion, from quality to convenience, affordability, and experience. So it was things which people like me never paid attention to while taking care of patients. The physician mindset is 99% about quality.
Right.
Am I doing the right thing? What are my outcomes compared to whatever? It's really not about the experience, et cetera. Affordability, we're, as I said, we're concerned, but clueless. Ask your doctor how much this is going to cost. You're not going to get a straight answer. And if you do, it's probably wrong. So it's just not something that was part of the physician mindset. Now it has to be. If you are going to be successful in the practice of medicine, and you ignore these things, you're not, as I said, if you don't pay attention to the business of medicine, you have no business practicing medicine. You will eventually go out of business.
But let me ask you this, but is it also a response to a need for easy, quick access for some of the more pedestrian kinds of things? I remember when my kids were all student athletes, I could go to the grocery store, get their physical so that they could participate in sports. We can get the flu shot. Does that not serve an important role of not bogging down in sort of a traditional triage system of bogging down for what really is needed for the more intensive collaborative approach?
Right. So that falls under the category of unbundling primary care. You can't be all things to all people. I mean, you can't, you know, you can, but it's terribly inefficient.
Right.
And it does not maximize the value of a doctor. It wastes their time, frankly, given the present environment. And that is the part of the advantage of retail medicine, as long as you understand that what you are being treated for in a retail environment is pretty much low acuity care. Prevention, vaccinations, having blood drawn, getting a test, something like that. If you have chronic kidney disease with six other morbidities, you're not going to a retail clinic. So it's so it has to be segmented. And in my view, not only does primary care have to be unbundled internally, I actually think we need two separate systems. We need a sick care system and we need a healthcare system. I don't believe doctors can do both. They're simply not trained to do it, whether it's population health, preventive medicine, et cetera, and they don't get paid to do it.
Right.
So I think it's unrealistic to burden a physician and hold them accountable for doing that. I just don't think that's doable. So ultimately, I think we're going to see a segmentation of the two systems. And oh, by the way, I think the next phase of the evolution of medicine will probably be do-it-yourself at-home care. We're already seeing that.
Yep.
Hospitals at home. I mean, now you can pretty much take care of yourself on the internet. Ultimately, I think we're going to see radiology at home. We're going to see lab tests at home. I even think we're going to see surgery at home. So we're not done yet. This thing is going to continue to evolve, and that's going to place a lot of challenges in front of, not the least, the medical education establishment. Because how do we teach residents and medical students how to do this?
Well, and you're seeing massive disruption in industries where one, I think people are taken very much off guard. And I know you do a lot with the sort of the craniofacial and taught dentistry as well. Probably the best example is Invisalign, which gave way to Smile Direct Club. I mean, Invisalign allowed other practitioners who weren't necessarily orthodontics to do orthodontics. And now you don't need to see a doctor at all. And they'll pay lip service. You'll see somebody online, but I can't imagine graduating today from medical school as an orthodontist and turning on a commercial for Smile Direct Club. But as we talk about online, and I think we could do a whole conversation about what surgery might look like at home, it's mirroring a lot of other industries though, right? I mean, we're being asked and being empowered to self-triage. Right. If we think it's something basic, we can go to that aspect and maybe unburden, or maybe we couldn't get in for 6 weeks for our primary care for something more in depth.
Right. The analogy, this applies particularly to Gen Z. It's just a different generational mindset. You know, they're used to looking up stuff, everything online and ChatGPT and you name it. So, and what I call this is over-the-counter medicine. So back in the day, if you wanted a prescription for something, you had to have a doctor write the prescription. Now there's a process for converting these prescription drugs to over-the-counter. You just go and you buy them online. I'm foreseeing and saying that we're sort of already in that phase where you can take care of yourself online without a prescription. Now,
absolutely,
there's a downside to DIY medicine. In other words, and there are perils of people taking care of themselves, not the least of which is they make the wrong diagnosis, they do the wrong thing, they take stuff they shouldn't take, they're misled with misinformation and false advertising about things. So it's happening now. We just need to be sure, for the sake of improving patient outcomes, that they understand the risks and the benefits of DIY medicine.
Let's talk about one of the challenges with that, which is confirmation bias, right? Of course, the promise of the internet was with all of this new information, we would become much more knowledgeable, much more empowered. And now we retreat into our camps. If you are an anti-vaxxer, there are not enough hours in the next 1,000 years to consume all the content that will validate your opinion. How has this been a struggle? I saw online there was a meme, and it showed in a doctor's office, and it was a picture of a Google logo, And it said, it was on the doctor's office wall. And it said, my medical degree is worth more than your Google search. But it's not just a Google search. It's the erroneous information. It's the dangerous information. I mean, there are 1,000 sites that prove beyond a doubt in their contention that the world is flat. It's the same thing. There's a danger in that. Talk about that.
Right. So the danger is as you implied, is the misinformation, not necessarily the information. And for example, let's get back to patient engagement and why whatever you call these people, customers or patients, leave. It has to do with, as you said, confirmation bias. Basically, people buy emotionally and justify rationally. So it really, and in the age of artificial intelligence, we know what trips your emotional triggers to buy. So if I'm trying to sell you, quote, or to treat you, quote, I know what's going to trip your trigger. All you have to do is look at things that don't necessarily have demonstrated benefit to treat your ailment. Now, I don't want to get into the, we could get into the conversation of vitamins, nutraceuticals, magnetic bracelets, you name it. We all know this, and some would argue digital health is snake oil. So what is real and what is snake oil? And why is it that some people, patients, customers, whatever you call them, buy your product? Because it trips an emotional trigger. And that is informed by your experience, confirmation bias, all the other stuff. So that's why I'm saying that whether you perceive a patient as a patient or a patient as a customer determines how you will market and engage them.
It's a great perspective. It's a great perspective.
Yeah, you might not like that. You may like it. I don't know. But it that's what we're seeing. And incidentally, the United States, for example, is only one of two countries in the world that allows TV pharmaceutical advertising. The other is New Zealand. But how many doctors do you see on television, unlike lawyers, advertising their latest femtech thing? They don't do it. And there's a reason for it. And it has to do with the culture of medicine, not the least of which State Board of Medical Examiner regulations and oversight concerning truthful advertising by a healthcare profession.
Well, and it's constraints that are imposed upon people who are truly in the healthcare profession who've taken the Hippocratic Oath that don't apply to those who may believe in their heart of hearts, though there is no clinical evidence to support that, or they can't make those claims to the FDA, that this particular erectile dysfunction pill or this test, it's got testofen, which of course means not testosterone, right?
And the dirty little secret in medicine is doctors don't like it when other doctors say I'm better than you.
Right.
They simply don't like it. And I've had that experience. I've had doctors pull me over in a hallway and say, what makes you think you're so good? Literally. So it's a culture. It's what happens inside. So consequently, when you grow up to be a doctor, you don't do it. But yeah. I'm not necessarily sure that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying that it is what it is.
Well, and we look at sort of the convergence from a consumer perspective, and I'm absolutely going to use the terminology. We're patients. In this context, we are patients. But people see themselves as patients in a naturopathic environment. They see themselves as patients because they believe enough websites and I'm not going to do chemo and I'm just going to do, and I don't want to stoke anything, whether it's prayer or vitamins or those other things that people believe in their heart and of hearts. And there's enough evidence in some realm that will help them believe it. But there's the convergence is interesting because I work with so many different industries. We are consumers of healthcare. There are new easy access, and then there's things that make things more difficult. So it's something I would love to touch base from time to time. I think from the consumer perspective, it's the same across industry. We're looking for ease and simplicity and confidence and convenience, which
well,
is a challenge.
Those are different value factors that different patients want. You can't just say everybody wants that. they sort, I mean, does everybody want a decent patient experience? Sure.
Sure, right.
But when it comes to, for example, when it comes to choosing a doctor, doctors basically do two, three things. They make decisions. They do procedures and things, and they communicate, empathize, bedside manner, whatever you call it. Patients are different. Some will say, you know what? And I've had people tell me this. I don't care that you're a cold fish. I heard you're a good diagnostician and a good technician. Okay, great. I am what I am. I think it's pretty hard to be a triple threat. But other people will say, this guy is impossible. He doesn't listen to me. He doesn't talk to me. He spent 5 minutes talking to me. I wouldn't go to him if he were the last doctor on earth. Okay. So so not everybody wants the same thing. And, oh, by the way, there are certain patients that will say, this guy charges a fortune. He must be much better than everybody else.
Right. Perception of quality.
Yeah.
Right. What's interesting also is almost the level of care dictates that as well. For my pediatrician, for when my kids were small, I wanted somebody who had a great bedside manner, who could talk my kids through their vaccinations, right? I'm going in for surgery on a sensitive body part. I want swagger. I want to see that surgeon hang up his cape and sword as he walks into that ER. I don't care about the arrogance at that point. Listen, we could talk forever. It's fascinating to look at the changes of how we access care. Certainly the growth, the face-to-face virtual visits that I was doing before, because I travel extensively. My healthcare is through Kaiser, and because I'm in Colorado, it's just a few states. So that teledoc has been part of my life for a lot of years, but for a lot of people, this is a new thing, and it's preventing people from having to go into the office and all those. Well, so real quickly, a couple of minutes left. Let me do a quick speed round for you and give me quick answers on these things. Would it be beneficial for medical students to be required to take business classes as well?
Yes. In fact, we are working very hard to do that.
Yeah. I mean, we saw that for years. A lot of them who are in practice, they're very good at the clinical side, but they were not told here's how to buy the equipment and set up the practice as well. Tell me, in your opinion, the best and worst things about virtual doctor visits face-to-face. What's the best part of it? What's the worst part about it?
The best part is convenience. The worst part about it is that there are some things that just simply are not amenable to telemedicine. And my specialty in ENT is an example. If you look at the specialties that use telemedicine, ENT is very down on the list, because if you have a laryngeal or a voice problem, I can't tell you what's going on unless I can put a scope in your nose and look at your voice box. And generally, you can't do that via telemedicine.
Absolutely. What do you think is a growing unrealistic expectations of Americans specifically in terms of their healthcare? What are the most unrealistic expectations?
That the U.S. healthcare spend will diminish over the next 5 years, that every year we say it is an unsustainable increase in GDP spend. That is not going to happen, in my opinion, in the foreseeable future. And the only way we're going to change that is through legislation and rules.
Who do you see leading that conversation in your work with the entrepreneurial community within healthcare? Do you see that as a group of outliers, more creative ways of looking at how do we deliver, how do we create the technologies and the delivery systems outside of the traditional hospital-based system?
Right. Another unrealistic expectation is that sick care can be fixed from inside. People like me are people that contributed to the problem, and now you're expecting me to solve it. The fact of the matter is that almost no industry can be fixed from inside, and changes in sick care will come from outside of sick care, as you're seeing now. Aerospace, nano, IT, artificial intelligence, nanomaterials, media, technology, all that stuff. That's what's informing, and retail. That's what's informing the change. So I tell people, if you want to see innovation in healthcare, don't go to a medical meeting.
Is it because there's a financial incentive to do so?
It's because because it's the largest industry in the United States, and $4.3 trillion attracts a lot of pigs to the trough.
Who are very protective of that trough.
Yeah, and people that don't want to give up their vested interest.
Understandable. Dr. Arlen Myers, I love these conversations. I spent the first 10 years of my career in healthcare. In healthcare communication. So for me, revisiting all of this is fascinating. If people want to learn more about you and learn about the Society for Physician Entrepreneurs, how do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so the best way is to get to me on LinkedIn. I'm always, you know, I'm sort of all over the internet. I'm pretty hard to ignore. And the second is that the Society of Physician Entrepreneurs is at www.sopenet.org. It's an open innovation network, so you don't have to be a doctor or a surgeon or a health professional to join.
And if somebody that has some sort of services or support or interest in that, it's a great organization. I'm a member of it as well. Dr. Myers, thanks for being with us. Hang on. I'll talk to you on the other side. I just want to remind everybody you can pick up a copy of my new book, The Morning Huddle, Powerful Customer Experience Conversations to Wake You Up and Shake You Up and Win More Business. In fact, all of my books that are strategically located next to my head are available on Amazon, some of those in other languages, an audiobook and everything else as well. Be sure to subscribe, click to like this podcast, leave a comment, and click the little bell. You'll receive notifications. We have new episodes here for the new season. Thanks for tuning in once again to the Why Customers Lead podcast. Big thanks to my guest, Dr. Arlen Myers. I'm David Averin. Be good.
This has been the Why Customers Leave podcast with David Averin. Be sure to leave a comment and click the like button. You can listen to or watch past episodes and be notified of future ones by hitting the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform or check them out on David Averin's YouTube channel. David's popular books are all available online and also in Kindle and audiobook form as well. You can learn more about David's keynote speaking and business consulting at davidaverin.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.